Good afternoon. Nurturing children from difficult backgrounds. 10 years ago in the spring of 2016, my wife and I arrived back in the States from a trip to Zhengzhou, China. We'd been there to adopt a two-year-old daughter. We'd been there in 2015 to adopt a son, went back in 2016 again to adopt a two-year-old daughter. And when we arrived back in the States, my wife got on the phone with UPMC, Pittsburgh Children's Hospital, called them up, and she told them, "We don't know exactly what we have here yet, but we're coming." We knew we were dealing with some vision issues. And so over the next couple of months, we worked our way up through the network in the hospital there. Eventually arrived at the top to the director, made our way to the director of ophthalmology. The director of ophthalmology at the time was an Indian man, Dr. Nishal. Very kind, compassionate, competent man. You know, sometimes with these specialists, they can have an IQ in the stratosphere, but their PR skills are maybe a little like a billy goat. Our experience with Pittsburgh was never that way. I'm not sure if they find these people or if they train them in, but our interactions with the staff there were always exceptional. And so Dr. Nishal is examining our daughter, and I heard him say in somewhat of an undertone to one of his colleagues, he said, "We're dealing with a number of issues here. Complete blindness in one eye, the other eye has limited vision, esotropia, nystagmus, morning glory syndrome, a number of other conditions." He said, "You know, I think there's a genetic component here, and I think there's also an environmental component." He said, "The last time I was in Henan province, I treated probably a dozen children with similar eye conditions. And I think there's definitely a genetic component to it because it does seem like it's clustered in that area, but particularly around Zhengzhou City. Zhengzhou is an old industrial city, and I think there's an environmental component to this too." And I interrupted him and I said, Did I hear you right? Did you say you've been in Henan province in Zhengzhou City?" He said, "Yeah, I do a couple medical missions a year typically. Been there a number of times. Henan province down in through Zhengzhou City, know exactly where you're at there." And following that visit, then they brought in the neurology team, and the neurology team said, "Just one thing we want to talk to you about. We do have some concerns here that possibly we're dealing with moyamoya." Moyamoya is a disease. It's a Japanese term for puff of smoke. Comes from moyamoya is a disease that comes from the blood vessels to the brain becoming occluded, and then around those points of occlusion, they'll grow a network of small blood vessels to try to feed blood to the brain. And so when you do an angiogram, it shows up on there as a puff of smoke, hence the term. Primarily an Asian disease. And the interesting thing with it is it's more prevalent in young children and twice as prevalent in girls as boys. I've wondered about that already. Maybe we just watch the boys and we think boys are being boys and don't diagnose them properly, but it is more prevalent in girls. And so they did an angiogram there and came back and they told us, "Yes, her carotid arteries are 90% occluded. We need to do surgery. There's not," and they told us this then, "there's not many centers in the U.S. that do this. It's an Asian disease, only a couple thousand documented cases in the U.S. And so there's only a handful of children's centers in the U.S. that even do the surgery. But they said it just so happens that we're one of the few that are actively doing this surgery. We have our own in-house Dr. Green. again, a very kind, compassionate woman. She was older, probably pushing 60 at the time, had been doing the surgery for several decades, and she'd treated people from all over the world with this condition. And so they opened her schedule up. She's always booked months in advance. They opened her schedule up, got the surgery done within the next several weeks. It was a 10-hour brain surgery there. Got it done. Fast forward about 5 years, and that little girl went out the door to first grade, first day of first grade, and her eyes weren't exactly sparkling because they don't sparkle. But she had a big smile on her face, black pigtails bouncing, lunchbox swinging. She was all excited about first day of first grade. And we stood there and watched that and said, what a miracle. What a series of miracles. What are the chances that we go to Pittsburgh, our nearest big city hospital, and there's a Dr. Nischel there that just happened to have been to Henan province and treated her extended cousins and knew exactly what he was looking at? What's the chances that before we even tell the doctors exactly what we're dealing with and what we're seeing, that they come in and say, what about this? We better get you tested for this. They just happen to know about it and happen to have a doctor on call that does this surgery. You can't orchestrate those details in life. And we look at that and we say, what a miracle that she is the child she is. And at the same time we say that, then we worry too. We remember the day she was going off to surgery and the medical orderly that told us, no worries, ma'am. We'll give her the best possible care. And we hope that our own schools and our school administrations will do that, that they'll be as kind and compassionate and competent as that medical staff was. That they'll look past maybe some of the idiosyncrasies of these children and see what they are and what they've been through and what they can become. And in our case, with that particular child, it just, again, so happened that her first grade teacher was an experienced teacher. She'd grown up in a home that did foster care. And she did very, very well with that child. And we have, through our school years, we've had many good teachers, many good experiences. It's been overwhelmingly positive. But these children do come with difficult backgrounds sometimes and difficult cases. I would like to look at a couple verses from Luke 10, 30 to 35, some very familiar verses. Story of the Good Samaritan. I'll just read a couple verses. And Jesus answering said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. And by chance there came down a certain priest that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise a Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked on him and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And on the morrow, when he departed, he took out 2 pence and gave them to the host and said unto him, take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest more when I come again, I will repay thee. You've all been sitting for a while. Why don't we stand for a minute? And from this passage, can you give me just a couple of the things that the Good Samaritan supplied that wounded man? Simple things. What were they?
Time.
Oil. Oil.
Compassion.
Compassion.
Second chance on life.
Second chance.
Touch.
I'm sorry?
Touch.
Touch.
Transportation.
A room in the inn. Very good. The outstanding thing to me about all of those components was just how everyday they are. It didn't require an advanced education. Didn't require special talents, really. It didn't require 500 pages being committed to the Torah. Didn't require a special animal even. Just simply calls it a beast, most likely a donkey. And in fact, the very men that had some of those abilities, talents, and could have provided that, looked at them and went on. We don't judge them. They were probably busy men. They may have needed to be in Jerusalem that night for sacrifices. They might have had important meetings to be at. No one person can supply all the needs of the world, and we each have to know our fields and know where our abilities are. But the interesting thing about dealing with these children so often is that it doesn't necessarily require special resources. It requires resources that are available to every one of us. Compassion, a Walmart first aid kit, common old donkey, time, a willingness to get dirty. He got dirty. He had to get down in the gravel there. Until he was done, he probably had some dust and blood on him. It took time, took a bit of money. But there are things that are available to any of us. It's a work that all of us can be involved in. You may say it. And I want to be clear. Naivete is no virtue. There's no premium on being dumb, if you will. But compassion must be the starting point. These children, particularly these children that come from these difficult situations, are often hyper-vigilant, hyper-alert. They know who cares, and they know who's genuine and who's not, and they will pick it up. A couple verses from 1 Corinthians 13, 1-3, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I become a sounding brass or a tingling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profits me nothing. Compassion must be our starting point. It is part of the work. We need to understand, too, with these children, that there's a big difference between won't and can't. Let me tell you one other story yet. This one goes back about 30-some years ago, I guess. The country of Romania. Late 80s, Nicolae Ceaușescu is the dictator there. Coming into the winter of 1989, the people had finally had enough. He's been the dictator for 20-some years. There's austerity measures in place. People are frustrated. He comes out on the balcony there to give a speech. And the people, for the first time, dare to openly boo him. And things turn fast from there. Within a couple days, the military arrests him, gives him a quick military trial. And Christmas Day 1989, they execute both Ceaușescu and his wife by firing squad. Following that, that country opened up a bit to the Western world, or to the outside world. And one of the things that the outside world learned about it was all of the children that were being institutionalized there. Ceaușescu, back in the 60s and 70s already, had embraced a policy of raising up an army of workers. And so he had outlawed abortion and contraceptive. I believe it was 1977, they started finding families that did not have enough of children. There was a strong push on to have children. And it resulted in tens of thousands of unwanted children on the streets there, and so they began institutionalizing them. 1989, when the country opened, there was somewhere between 100 and 170,000 children in state-run institutions. The disabled were probably the ones that suffered the most. In a communist society, unless you have something to contribute, you don't have much worth. And so particularly the disabled and the mentally disabled in particular suffered. There was somewhere around 10 to 15,000 mentally disabled children that were recorded, deaths are recorded from the 1980s there. Many of them simply neglected to the point that they died. And so when the country opened in 1989, one of the things they opened up was international adoption. I grew up with a girl that came, that was adopted from there. We weren't in the same community, but our families knew each other well. And she was a child with some disabilities. Fairly obvious fetal alcohol syndrome, along with she had childhood AIDS. That was very prevalent in those orphanages because they were in there oftentimes 2, 3, 4 to a bed, shared utensils, shared baby bottles and so on. And so AIDS spread like wildfire through those orphanages. So she came to the U.S. here. A year or two after she came here, she started school. And it was in one of these, well, it's the early 1990s, so we didn't know as much about some of these things then either. One of the things that the Romanian situation supplied us was a lot of medical research on some of these conditions, understanding the effects that neglect and abuse have on children. We know more now than we did. 1990s, not so much was known. And it was in one of these settings, too, maybe where the path to adulthood is 18 years long and 2 inches wide. Children needed to fit into a box, and it was a small box. And her parents talk about how she went to school when she got spanked, and the administration really doubled down on that. Spanking is the answer. Spanking is the Bible way. If one spanking doesn't work, then give her 2 or 3 or 22 or 3. Eventually, she'll catch on. And they talk about through her first half of the school year, some years were worse than others, but there was quite a number of doctor appointments that they skipped due to the bruises that she had on her body from the spanking she was receiving at school. Some years it was a weekly occurrence, if not a daily. Along with that, too, was the added thing of having AIDS. And it scared some people. It's a contagious disease. We didn't know exactly what it was. Most people in our circles are compassionate and understanding. But there's always those few, right? And some of those, there was a few families that said, you look, even in the Old Testament, God told them to take the leper outside the camp. What are we doing bringing this into our circles? And so when she did get out to recess, then there was that, where some of the children simply wouldn't get close to her. Stay away from me. I'm not allowed to play with you. You're sick. We need to understand with that there's a big difference between won't and can't. And again, coming back around to this compassion thing, there needs to be room in our hearts, even for some of these contagious diseases. We need to be willing to take some risk. A child like that, it's not her fault. She's been born with that rather unfortunate deck of cards. Nothing that we did to get to be born with the deck of cards we have. None of us are exactly viable either. Stark naked, all alone in a blizzard on the North Pole. We all need help from the community. Let's pivot a bit while we're talking about this. Our brains are not just genetics. One of the amazing things about our brains is the plasticity that it, particularly in a child, the plasticity that it can experience. Relationships, experiences of life all help to shape the brain. Human interactions help to wire and develop it. But we need to understand that a brain that's developed under trauma and stress, constantly dealing with survival situations, is going to wire differently and function somewhat differently than a normal brain. So when we're born, the lower part of the brain, the brain stem, the limbic areas, amygdala, so on, are basically pre-wired. The areas of the brain that control functions such as breathing, eating, sleeping, obviously they're already wired in place in order for us to be a viable human. But the upper parts of the brain, the cerebrum, including areas like the frontal cortex, the the left and right hemispheres, cerebral cortex, all the parts of the brain that develop, that govern emotions, complex processing, relational interactions, speech, all of those parts are not yet developed. And so when a child is born into trauma and survival situations, in many cases, the lower part of the brain will overdevelop. Areas such as the amygdala that help to look for danger. Those children are constantly scanning the room, reading people's faces, reading their expressions, hypervigilant, not entirely focused with what they're doing here because they're listening to a conversation over there, constantly scanning their environment, watching for danger. And that will overdevelop the bottom part of the brain, but at the expense of getting the proper wiring done to the top part. An easy way for me to think about it is as an electrical service in a house. When these children are born, the electrical service is in the basement. The lights are on in the basement. Everything's home there. But the electricians haven't come in yet and done the upper stories. The wiring isn't run. The lights aren't on. And if they're dealing with difficult survival situations or born with things such as fetal alcohol, the many different type of disabilities that may accompany these situations, if the wiring ever gets run at all, many times it's not run correctly. There'll be, when you flip on the light switch, some lights will come on, others won't. It'll be a bit of a Swiss cheese type of brain where some of the cheese is there, but there's holes in it. At times, the lights will come on, but if they become overwhelmed, they'll go into the fight, flight, or freeze modes, where the fuses will blow and the lights will start to go back off again. And we have to understand, too, that when children are in these situations, the brain that stays in that fight, flight, or freeze mode too long will start to organize itself around survival at the expense of other healthier brain development. Additionally, things like brain chemistry and hormone levels can become unbalanced. A child that's constantly under stress, that their body's constantly producing adrenaline and cortisol, can develop lifelong issues. Just the toxic mix of long-term problems. Eating disorders is quite prevalent. If you're working with these children, that's more of a parent side of thing, I suppose. But one of the books that is helpful in that is the book Love Me, Feed Me, written by a doctor. She's done a lot of work with thousands of these children. If you're dealing with those types of behaviors, it's a good book to read. Along with that is all the other gamut of diseases that may develop, cardiovascular disease, antisocial behaviors, depression, all of those things that can come from a brain that did not develop properly in its formative years. The point is that when you're working with these children from these difficult backgrounds, we need to understand the difference between won't and can't. And spanking isn't always the entire answer. In fact, you very well might push those children into a survival mode where they're just shutting down on you, and it's no longer discipline, it's simply abuse. I'll give you one other example of that. We had a child a few years ago that wouldn't drink from a cup. It was really kind of provoking, I thought. Like, how hard can this be? It's about two steps, right? Step number one, wrap your fingers around the cup. Step number two, dump the contents down your throat. There's not that much to it. Put the cup up and let's drink it. You're 5 years old, let's go, right? And she just would not. It became a battle of wills and really could look like a discipline issue. At the time, we were doing some therapy, and my wife mentioned it to the therapist, and we had good therapists at the time. Not all therapists are created equal, but that one was particularly good. And she said, well, one thing to consider, this was a child from a third world orphanage. She said, one thing to consider, many times in these orphanages, they'll go down through and they'll slit the nipples on the bottles open in order to get the, you know, times of the essence here. We don't have enough of caretakers, so let's keep it moving. So they'll open the nipples up on the bottles so the bottle empties faster. She said there's a very good chance that she nearly drowned a time or two when she was young. The brain very well may have no recollection of that, no conscious memory of it. She can't tell you what happened, but it's simply when she brings that cup to her lips, the survival side of her brain kicks in and tells her, don't do it, and it overrides the logic side. She said, just start in slow once. Have her practice picking a cup up, touching it to her lips, eventually put a few drops of water in, and take it slow. And you know, that did make the difference. Over the course of a number of months, eventually she got to the point that today we don't think of it anymore. She drinks just like any normal child. But there was something in her brain that wasn't wired right, where the survival side kicked in and overrode the logic side. Takeaway message in all that is that trauma does damage a developing brain, alters its construction, upsets the delicate balance of brain chemistry, which in turn does affect behavior and puts a child at risk of a lifetime of behavior problems. But if we understand the factor and risk, we can minimize the damage. A child's brain, particularly through their formative years, does have a lot of plasticity. Brain regulation can be altered over time by four main factors: safety, nutrition, regulation of their environment, and exercise. Four important things. I'm trying to decide what all to go over here, but one thing I'll just mention quickly, beware of the triangulation. Might be a word to write down and look up later. Triangulation manipulation is a tactic whereby the manipulator brings a third party into conflict or relationship to create chaos and control communication, such as they'll sometimes slander an authority figure or tell a twisted story, work one authority against another. You can go read up on that yourself, but it's a condition that has broken churches and schools up already. Just be aware of those behaviors. Another source, a good source of information on much of this out there is the Karen Purvis Foundation. Again, she's not Bible. Eat the meat and spit out the bones, but you can look her up online. Karen herself died a few years ago, but her foundation lives on, and they have a lot of helpful information out there. One of the things she talks about is what she calls the ideal response. IDEAL as an acronym. The I is immediate. When you're dealing with these children and discipline issues, don't store up things until the lid comes off the kettle. Deal with the issues as they come along, and then move on and let them in the past. Don't bring them up again. The D is direct. Don't yell at them from across the room. Get within 3 feet of them. Deal with them directly in a calm voice. Don't be critical of them, but you do need to confront behaviors that are unacceptable. Don't go behind their backs with stories. Don't betray their trust and confidence. Talk directly to them. The E is efficient, as in don't overreact. Don't go after a mosquito with an elephant gun. Recently I heard of a situation where a child went to first grade and she was new to the country here, still learning the language, had no siblings in school. And in her first week of school, she got spanked for chewing on her pencil. It was a new teacher, and the teacher had said, no, don't chew on your pencils. And she came by and saw a couple bite marks and said, "Were you chewing on your pencil?" And the child said, "No." And the teacher took her out and spanked her for lying to her. If you're going to go after that with an elephant gun, what are you going to do when she lies defiantly? Bring in the Iranian firing squad? Where do you go from there? In those kind of situations, try to de-escalate where you can. Be reasonable. Don't lead these children into a situation where you force them into a lie. Don't panic. There's no job opening for panic pushers, and if there was, there's plenty of people to fill that position anyway. It's not necessary to run around like you're the third monkey on the ramp to Noah's Ark and it's starting to rain. There are answers. And these children need calmness and consistency. The A in idea was action-based. There's a thing called a sensory neural motor loop, which is simply another way of saying it is, if I do the thing that I heard about, it creates a body memory. The old thing of obedience first and understanding can come later sometimes. If you do what you're told, it creates a body memory, and then as you continue to do it, it creates a sensory neural motor loop where your brain defaults to that action. As you train these children in the right behaviors, they eventually will become a default setting. And the L is leveled at the behavior, not the child. When you have situations with these children, when you're all done dealing with them, you want three things. You want a child that has the behavior changed. You want a child that's more connected to you than before. And you want a child that's content because they did the right thing and they know they did the right thing. The requirements were clear, they knew what to do, and they're content that they did it. And I would say yet too, I'd reached out to a couple other people and asked them in working on this topic here, what are some of the things that you would say, what would you tell this crowd in working with your children? One family in particular that I talked to, they recently moved from another state, partly because of the school situation. And they said what made a big difference for them was that their new school, their school board was willing to take the time, spend the resources that were needed to get in the curriculum that they needed. The school they had been at said, well, if you want special curriculum, you can buy it and you can give it to the child after school. Here's what we offer and here's what we have for you. And they went to a new school where they were willing to work with them to give them the resources they needed for their children. And she said it made such a difference because many times these children are stressful, are stressed at school, and they come home from school and they're tired. And so if you're going to try to give them 3 hours of homework after school yet, it just doesn't go well. There's a point where you need to let the mom be the mom, let the teacher be the teacher. When they come home from school, they need to be able to put the school day behind them, particularly if schooling is hard for them. Get an afternoon snack, do their chores, get on their bike, and do what normal children do after school. So there's only so much you can do outside of school, after school. Find things they excel at. If a child struggles in school, find something that they enjoy and that they can excel at, that you can praise them for. If they're good at sports, find some games they can play. Bring in some running games. Set up a pickleball court. Find an incentive program, for example, that they can excel at also, not that just the smart ones can, but that everyone can be involved in. Don't Don't be afraid to ask for help. One of the things about where we're at today in 2026 is that there are a lot of resources out there. Karen Purvis Foundation is one of them. In the States, we have the WELAMS Adoption Resources Board, which there's men that sit on there that are talented, capable men. Therapists have their place. There's a lot of special curriculum out there. Be willing to invest the time and the money into it that's needed to get the results you need. And finally, never estimate what simple time, love, good food, and common sense can do for a child. Much of this isn't rocket science. It's time, it's compassion, caring enough to get involved, put some sweat and blood and tears into it. And with that, we have 4 minutes yet. A bit of time for question and answer. Any questions, any discussion? Anything that could be said in a better way? Action-based. Leveled at the behavior, not the child, but at the behavior.
How do you spell Karen's last name?
Karen Purvis, Purvis. Maybe we're like the Amish lined up in the porch at Pinecraft in Florida. We have answers, all we need is some problems yet. That was their joke, not mine. Any more discussion? What should have I covered that I didn't? We didn't a lot. I mean, certainly don't underestimate the benefit of exercise. But in our case, we only ever took one child to therapy, and that was more with just what I mentioned, as in oral aversions and eating disorders and so on. So that was our experience. But there's probably more in the room here that have, others in the room that have more experience with that. Many times with children from difficult backgrounds, in most cases it's probably a survival mechanism. Playing one authority against another, getting the focus off of themselves. It can also be a manipulation mechanism where they, by creating chaos and controlling communication where they feel like they're in control, it's not always children that do it either. Sometimes these children grow up to become parents. It can be the adults in the room that sometimes cause the trouble in school too, where they're, in adults, it may oftentimes be more They'll slander others, or they'll portray themselves as the victim, slant facts against two people in authority to pit those two authorities against each other. There's no easy answers to it. You simply need to be aware. Be aware when it's happening. It has broken churches and schools up already. Yes, with that, I would say again that probably the example of our daughter with making such a scene out of something as small as drinking out of a cup is an example of that, where the brain wiring isn't there, and to some extent at times brute force can carry you over the line. But it's not going to build a connection. It's going to many times cause long-term issues, security issues, and so on. How do you decipher between the two? It takes the wisdom of Solomon many times. I would say if there's a behavior that you're having trouble deciding if it's a can or a can't or a won't issue, if there's something that consistently, an issue that consistently causes a problem, then there's probably some background to it. Another situation I can think of with that is we have friends that one of their boys, anytime there was a birthday party, they would erupt. And to the uninitiated or to the casual bystander, it really looked like it was simply a spoiled brat issue where someone else is getting a birthday gift and they just melt down because of it. But the background to that was that it was a child that had been in one of these dysfunctional homes. Step-siblings, revolving boyfriends. And some of his step-siblings had gotten birthday gifts. And he had never in his life received a birthday gift. And one of the things, see, abuse is a serious thing. But in a case with abuse, the adult is telling the child, I see you and I don't like you. Neglect is simply, I don't even see you. And the fallout, long-term effects from neglect can be just as serious as abuse. In his situation, he had a lot of anger issues. He was a boy that would, once in a while, he would get upset, get very angry. And all right, I've had it, I'm running away from home. And he would run out the lane and run down the road. And his mom learned after a few times that he's probably not going to run too far, no sense in fighting it. So she'd get in the vehicle and follow him down the road with the four ways on. And a few miles down the road, he would run out of steam and be winded. And then she'd pick him up and bring him back. Some of those behaviors just take time. Eventually, you can maybe get that child to the point where when they're going to run away from home, you can suggest they go to the basement and use the treadmill and run away that way, and that at least saves some gas and time for the rest of us. You know, you take them along in steps at times. Much of it is taking the time to try to understand if there's behaviors that cause consistent meltdowns. Many times there is trauma in the past in a particular situation or a setting like that where they, where it does stem from. And when we understand that, then we suddenly see it in a whole different light. Okay, anything else quickly?